Welcome to Greenwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Greenwire is produced at CKUT Radio on Mohawk territory in Montreal, Quebec. I'm Cecile Branco.
And I'm Aaron Lakoff.
In this edition,
we demand status for Kirshi Begum Awan now.
Obviously, the regulations in place don't really account for stuff like this. There's all kinds of kind of oilish fluid all over the place.
Divestment is basically the opposite, as a word, it's the opposite of investment. It's about pulling out or withdrawing investments that are unethical or morally bankrupt.
But first, here are the headlines.
November 28th marked the 100th day of sanctuary for Mrs. Khurshid Begum Awan, a Pakistani refugee who decided to defy a deportation order issued to her on August 21st, 2013. Since then, she has been forced to live in a church in Montreal until her status is regularized. Her supporters say this has not only caused inordinate daily stress for her, her daughter Tahira, and her grandson Ali, but has forced her to miss medical appointments and endure intimidation by Canada Border Services agents, or the CBSA. If deported to Pakistan, Mrs. Awan risks facing multiple forms of violence, including murder by members of the violent anti-Shia group Sipah-e-Sahaba. This is Alex Matak of the Awan Family Support Committee, speaking at a rally held outside the Immigration Canada offices in Montreal on the 100th day of sanctuary for Mrs. Awan.
We demand status for Khurshi Begum Awan now. We demand that her husband Mohammed be allowed to come back to Canada to live with his family and also be granted status now. And we demand that this amazing family be able to live a life of justice and dignity like they deserve.
For more information on the Awan family case or to support them, visit www.solidarityacrossborders.org.
On November 16, there was a national day of action called Defend Our Climate, Defend Our Communities. Rallies against pipelines, tar sands expansion, and fracking took place in 130 communities. On the day of the rally, Red Eye Co-op Radio spoke with Ben West of Forest Ethics about the significance of the rally and resistance to the Northern Gallery Project.
You know, after years of this campaign, I think we're going on over 5 years now that many of us have been working on this campaign to try to stop the Enbridge pipeline. We're now within weeks of a decision from the Joint Review Panel. And it's basically the last opportunity, for the federal government and the agencies of the federal government to really listen to the voices of the people of BC.
In early November, the BC and Alberta premiers made an agreement to push through the pipeline projects, despite BC Premier Christy Clark's previous opposition to the pipeline.
In the lead-up to the election, the submission to the Joint Review Panel was very clear. The government of BC was saying no to the Enbridge pipeline. Now it's not so clear. If you look at the agreement between Alberta and British Columbia, there's not a lot of detail there other than that they're going to work together to try to find a pathway for pipelines to be approved.
A decision from the Joint Review Panel evaluating the environmental effects of the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline is expected before the new year. The Ontario government has announced another decade-long plan to clear-cut in Grassy Narrows territory. On October 31st, the chief and council sent an open letter to Premier Kathleen Wynne stating that they oppose this plan based on the lack of consultation with the community and the infringement upon Aboriginal and treaty rights. The Grassy Narrows community is currently challenging the right of the Ontario government to issue logging permits in their territory in Supreme Court of Canada, though no date has been set for the hearing. Decades of logging in the Grassy Narrows territory have caused mercury poisoning with 60% of the community showing symptoms. Another round of the clear-cut logging will only exacerbate the mercury poisoning in the Grassy Narrows community. The Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources Forestry Management Plan is in its last rounds of negotiations and the decision is scheduled for December 23rd. Protesters led by the Mi'kmaq from Elsipuktuk First Nation successfully turned away Southwestern Energy Thumper trucks on November 28th and 29th. These demonstrations and resistance are slowing down Southwestern Energy's attempts to do seismic testing in the area. It has already been reported by Halifax Media Co-op that on-field shot holes are polluting the water. Miles Howe describes the scene. Watch the full video on Halifax Media Co-op website.
We have unfilled shot holes that appear to have broken an aquifer. There's one here, and it's made a huge mess already. Obviously, the regulations in place don't really account for stuff like this. There's all kinds of kind of oilish fluid all over the place. There's more broken shot holes, or shot holes that have broken an aquifer farther up here.
Earlier this month, on November 18, an injunction filed by Elsie Puktuk to stop seismic testing in the area was denied by Judge Judy Clendening. The same judge granted an injunction to SWN to keep protesters away from seismic testing sites later the same week. Five people were arrested during the protest on November 29th. Meanwhile, UBC students rallied in solidarity, calling to end the arrests on First Nations people on unceded territory and to stop state violence in Elsie Puktuk. The National Day of Action was held December 2nd, which included highway shutdowns and binary drops in many parts of Canada. And lastly, on November 27, the FRAPRU, a provincial social housing rights coalition in Quebec, held a demonstration with several hundred people on Parliament Hill in Ottawa to protest the Harper government's cuts to social housing. FRAPRU says that Harper must not sacrifice contribution to social housing by putting an end to the long-term federal subsidies that currently support 600,000 social housing units across Canada, including 127,000 houses in Quebec and 227,000 in Ontario. CKUT's Susan Fitch was in Ottawa to report on the protest and spoke with François Saillant, the spokesperson from FRAPRU.
We are here to remember the Prime Minister and all the government, the upper government, that there's still an housing crisis. There's still a lot of people in difficulties. The number of households, of tenants households, that pay more than 50% of their income for the rent has increased of 11% all across Canada since the arrival the power of Stephen Harper. Since in 5 years, it has increased of 11%.
The FRAPRU demands that a conservative government immediately commit to the continuation of subsidies that have supported Canadian low-cost housing initiative for decades.
And that's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. How can we trust the police with no justice, no peace? No justice, no peace. Yo, I'm trying to survive in these streets. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. There's so much money in the world, why people on the street? I seen an old lady digging in the garbage bin for something to eat. Some man died in the hospital, they thought he was asleep. A kind of world to a living when the rich don't want to give it to the poor. They didn't want to send us to war to kill each other for nothing. What is it all for? We're fighting for ourselves to survive, cause you're lucky if you make it past the age of 25. You all seen it happen way too many times. Somebody dying on the curb over words.
We just heard No Justice, No Peace by Warrior Minded and Dramatique.
Now it's time for our feature stories. University students are organizing from coast to coast to build a movement demanding that their school divest from fossil fuels. Jane Comrie from CGSF speaks with members of the SFU 350, a group of students organizing in Burnaby, BC, to get Simon Fraser University to divest from fossil fuels.
Divestment is basically the opposite, as a word, it's the opposite of investment. It's about pulling out or withdrawing investments that are unethical or morally bankrupt. So in SFU's perspective, or SFU 350's perspective, we want SFU to stop investing in fossil fuel companies with specifically their endowment fund and their investment fund, because we don't think that it is morally correct or ethical for SFU to be making money and profiting off of companies that in the long run are really going to be harming our future and are already harming our present, as you mentioned, with Typhoon Haiyan and other natural disasters and other droughts and everything that's going on already with climate change.
And there's a history of divestment. So it's happened before just now with fossil fuel companies. I've read about divestment from during South African apartheid, divestment from the tobacco industry. So why is it important for us to divest?
There's a couple reasons. First of all, there is an ethical argument for divesting from fossil fuel companies. So we know that fossil fuel companies are causing climate change, as well as they have a bunch of other kind of bad practices that we've seen in the news. And when you go to the tar sands, and there's huge impacts, health impacts on First Nations groups there. But we're specifically focusing on climate change as an issue and dealing with fossil fuel companies. So there's that kind of ethical issue of the fact that we're giving money to these companies. We're profiting off of their basically digging up these way too much carbon than we're supposed to be burning, encouraging us to burn it, and then causing climate change and causing all the things that come from climate change in the long run. But there's also an economic argument for it. We know that the world only has a certain carbon budget. In the most recent UN report, they basically said there's only a certain amount of carbon that we can burn. And they divided it out to different countries. And it's been determined that there's way more carbon reserves in the ground in Canada than we should ever be. I can't remember the exact number, but than we should ever be burning and allowed to burn if we're trying to stay below 2 degrees Celsius, which scientists have agreed is the amount that we should be keeping below, right, if we're going to actually be able to stop kind of runaway climate change. And so knowing that, we know that these companies are basically setting up, we're investing in them thinking they're going to be incredibly profitable when they're quantifying all of their kind of profitability on reserves that we know they can't take out of the ground.
When do you think that divestment could happen at SFU?
Well, I want to be really hopeful. I want to say we go into the Board of Governors and they all agree with us and they vote it through. I'm not entirely sure that'll happen.
Oh, I was just saying, yeah, we're definitely in this for the long term. We want to engage the entire community and want to build support from the students and the faculty and everybody involved with SFU. And the divest movement wants to push it, I mean, starting in different universities, and we want to build solidarity across institutions. So we're in this for the long game to make a big statement.
Our first ask is just trying to ask for them to actually look into their investments and give us some sense of transparency around how they're quantifying their investments in carbon and how they're quantifying what we already discussed as being carbon liability, so their risk in terms of what happens if these fossil fuel companies lose their value. So that is really what we're hoping at least comes out of January.
And what has inspired you guys within since you've gotten involved with Divest? Has there been anything in particular that's been really exciting or helped push you forward?
And seeing all the good news that keeps continually coming out, it's amazing. And every week, I go to the meeting and there's something new and something to push us forward. About having the dialogue. And I think the fact that there's the economic side of the issue really brings in a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily be joining an environmental movement. It's like people who want to see accountability and transparency in our investments. And it's the people who want to see that we have viable investments, period. So I think it's a great opportunity to bring a lot of different people together for something tangible. Yeah.
We've been joined today by Tony, Andrea, and Jesse from SFU 350, who've been advocating for divestment as part of a group of students committed to environmental conservation. So thank you so much for talking with us. This has been Jane Kamori with Intravenous, a women's issues show for women about women.
Hundreds of jail migrants are continuing a hunger strike in Leeds, Ontario, to push for improvements to their detention conditions. Saeed Hussein, a member of No One Is Illegal Toronto, was in Montreal recently to speak at the Building a Solidarity City conference organized by Solidarity Across Borders. CKUT's Matthew Brett sat down to speak with him about the hunger strike for Grand Wire.
Activists and prisoners are continuing to organize following the largest migrant prisoner hunger strike in Canadian history. Some 191 migrant detainees were separated from their families when they were relocated to Lindsay, Ontario's Central East Correctional Center. The detainees were beaten into their cells after refusing to enter on September 17, 2013, and this quickly spiraled into an unlimited hunger strike. The hunger strike has since wound down, but prisoners and supporters are continuing to organize despite the authorities' best efforts to stop them. Hassan is an organizer with the Immigration Detention Network. I spoke with Hassan recently and asked him what the prisoners' demands are, and here's what he said.
So on demands right now, we're saying that essentially that there should be an end to the lockups of people in maximum security prison. And then secondly from there, that there should be a lockup to indefinite detention. So we're saying that Canada needs to establish a 90-day bar on 90-day limit. And anyone who's locked up for more than that should be released immediately. Obviously, this isn't exactly what we want. We want an end to all detentions and deportations. But looking at the fact that the entire EU, the United States, Australia, sorry, not Australia, EU and the United States all have a limit, right? So they've got what's called a presumptive period. Within 90 days to 6 months, depending on the country, you have to release them. So the fact that Canada doesn't have it, it's contrary to the United Nations recommendations, and it's all contrary to the charter. So there's legal grounds, and there is enough, we believe, public outcry and sympathy around these issues to be able to at least win this as a first step.
Now, the situation has become quite critical. I want to play some audio of one of the detainees who is on hunger strike to give a sense of what it's like. So here is Amin.
My name is Amin, and my last name is Jasiri. I have lost 42 pounds. I was at 180 pounds, and now I'm at 138 pounds. You see, I'm on the hunger strike, right? We're on segregation going on 3 weeks now, 3-4 weeks. We get basically forgotten. And this is a place where they bring you if you are disorderly or you're a problem. And to them, their reasoning is they say that it is to monitor our health. I'm at Immigration Canada's mercy. They will release me or they will deport me when they decide to.
Now, Hassan told me that since the strike began, some prisoners have been reallocated to other prisons in order to break them up. But organizing still continues both on the inside and outside. Here's what Hassan had to say when I asked him what people can do in solidarity.
That these people decided to take a stand. Not just take a stand, but to actually physically put their lives on the line, right? Like, for someone to stop eating is to really reclaim, basically say, this is my mortality is the only thing that I have control over, and that I will snatch back. So that's extremely inspiring, and it shows how utterly urgent and necessary action is. So for listeners and readers who are reading and listening about this, wherever they are, I mean, people need to take action. We've got a bunch of action steps on our website, which is endimmigrationdetention.com, but also to reach out and join community struggles that, you know, their liberation is wrought up in, to connect with prison abolitionists, migrant justice issues, anti-racist activists, and to start organizing and start seeing even more so the connections between gentrification, lack of housing, impoverishment of racialized communities, and the simultaneous prison build and the massive deportation. And in fact, link it to the colonization here and the imperialism elsewhere. Right? This is one global system. People need to understand it as such. There's no such thing as the Canadian economy. It's a global economy and a global political structure. But there are places that people can intervene in locally. If there's a prison, people can go there. If there's a federal government, MP, people can act against them. If there's community organizations, people can join them. So, yeah, that's all.
Great. Thank you very much. So, speaking with Hassan, Hassan's an organizer with Known as Illegal and the Immigration Detention Network. So if you want to learn more about any of what we've discussed, you can check out Known as Illegal and also look up the Immigration Detention Network. The website again was?
Endimmigrationdetention.com.
So endimmigrationdetention.com. Check it out. And thank you very much.
On November 22nd, a Take Back the Night march was held in downtown Montreal and was organized by the Center for Gender Advocacy at Concordia University. CKUT Radio's Jamie McLean was there to file this feature report for Groundwire.
One night a year where people get to feel empowered and walk the streets and not be afraid. And even though that should happen every single night, and we should be doing this every night and feeling safe every night, it's important to get together and feel that solidarity and just like empowerment from each other. And I came to be part of that.
This year's march was hosted by the Center for Gender Advocacy at Concordia University and held a focus on
challenges faced by people with physical accessibility needs, as well as those faced by trans people. This is Amy Lowe of Accessibilize Montreal, a Cooper Concordia working group.
Part of taking back the night for me means having access to places in the night. Sometimes when I'm feeling insecure, say I'm walking home late at night, I often look for the nearest public space where I could go, or private enterprise, like a bar or a cafe or a death center, that I can step into in order to be surrounded by people and feel less insecure. And this summer I experienced the lack of access to those places when I was in a wheelchair, and I wasn't able to just pop into the local corner store because I literally couldn't get in, and that's a really scary feeling, being alone on the street and not having a place to go or the ability to feel safe by accessing buildings or what have you. Over 60% of women who have disabilities will experience some sort of gender violence. That's a lot, and that's exacerbated for girls who are living with disabilities. So there's often like stigma around speaking out against violence of all natures for everybody, and there's increased challenges for people who say have communication disabilities that affect the way they communicate or perhaps affect the way that people perceive what they say.
But I know that in most cities it is a non-mixed march, meaning that it is that only women and children are invited to participate. Oftentimes there'll be like a gathering at the end where men can join in. Here in Montreal, this is the second year that the Centre for Gender Advocacy has organized the march, and we made a decision to make it open to all genders and all experiences. Because although most acts of sexual violence are perpetrated against women, we felt that excluding men and excluding gender non-conforming people also erased a lot of experiences of sexual assault that we also need to be talking about. I think, from what I understand, sometimes Take Back the Night marches have, perhaps not everywhere, but I think in the past in Montreal they've had sort of an anti-sex worker, anti-pornography kind of vibe about them. And in the marches that we've organized, we've tried to really veer away from that. We really want to emphasize that everybody has the right to withhold their consent and to have that non-consent respected. And that applies even if you're a sex worker. Sometimes people have the idea that, oh, well, you're a sex worker, so that means you're just, you should be having sex with whoever, or you're available to have sex with anyone and anytime someone else wants. But that's actually not true. Everybody has the right to say no and to have their no respected. And so we really wanted to make sure that we had the voices of sex workers included, and to really just be clear that there are no exceptions with regards to the need to have a person's consent before engaging sexually with someone.
Julie Michaud of the Center for Gender Advocacy at Concordia University in Montreal, speaking about the Take Back the Night March, which happened in Montreal on Friday, November 22nd. I spoke to a few members of the crowd about what they expect to see from the march in the future and what motivated them to attend the march this year. This is Milena.
It would be really great to see it as more of a community march, and I mean, there is like efforts to reach out to Francophone communities, but I feel like that could be done more. And so for like, as they say, like Monsieur, Madame, tout le monde to be there, like not just people who know what rape culture and smash patriarchy means, but just like everyone.
Now it's time for our community radio report.
From November 25th to December 10th, the Women's International Network of the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, or AMARC, will actively participate in the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender Violence with an internet campaign to denounce all kinds of gender violence and comprising radio stations from around the world. The 2013 international theme of the campaign is From Peace at Home to Peace in the World, Let's Challenge Militarism and End Violence Against Women. The 2013 16 Days campaign advocates for awareness and action on the multifaceted intersections of gender-based violence and militarism, while highlighting the connection between the struggle for economic and social rights and ending gender-based violence. The theme focuses on militarism as a creation and normalization of a culture of fear that is supported by the use or threat of violence, aggression, as well as military intervention in response to political and social disputes or to enforce economic and political interests. Groundwire spoke with Sylvia Richardson, the vice president of AMARC North America in Vancouver, about the radio series.
Community radios, for me, are spaces for possibilities, is where we imagine, work towards creating, enabling new ways of being, new ways of imagining society, you know, in ways that can help us advance and develop a real sense of community, a sense of grounding ourselves, not just mentally or financially, but also spiritually to the earth, to who we are as human beings, to who we are as, you know, brothers, sisters, parents. There are so many things that we dismiss in how we identify. So when we think about violence and what violence does to any community, violence is this corrosive acid that destroys relationships, destroys communities. When a woman is violated, it's not just that woman that has been injured. I mean, we have to take very seriously the personal injury to us as women and the way we have naturalized the violence that, you know, rape, that femicides are now becoming the norm as, you know, as weapons of for war or weapons to coerce countries into conceding their resources, you know, or weapons to force communities into relinquishing their lands. This need to be addressed. And what we see within AMARC is that the community, in order to be whole, must do away with hierarchies, must do away with the need to dominate and control. And so it begins with us. It begins with us as community radios, imagining a society without that, trope of domination as necessary to organize ourselves. So I think that if violence against women can become the place of departure where we start to defend the rights of society, the rights of people to have, you know, food, clean air, it becomes a more sustainable movement because it's us together imagining something, that would create a society where everyone has access to all the necessaries for life.
The 16-day campaign started on November 25th with the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. It continued on November 29th with the International Women's Human Rights Defenders Day, followed by December 1st, World AIDS Day, December 6th, the commemoration day for the Montreal Massacre in 1989, and will end on December 10th for the International Human Rights Day. The podcast series can be downloaded at www.amarc.org. Additionally, you can also find Sylvia Richardson's recently published book, Flesh Mapping, Cartography of Struggle, Renewal, and Hope in Education, at our website, sylviarichardson.com.
That's it for this edition of Grand Wire, produced at CKUT Radio on Mohawk Territory in Montreal, Quebec. Headlines this week were written by Aaron Lakoff and Carly Forbes. We also thanks James Midguy, Red Eye Co-op Radio, Miles Howe, and Halifax Media Co-op. Tune in again to hear Grand Wire on your local community radio station or download at grandwire.ncra.ca. Grand Wire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.